Hey, everybody, welcome to the Monday edition of The Daily Friend. That's right, this is your wonderful, wonderful news, opinion, and analysis site. Remember, you can find all our work on the Daily Friend website. That's dailyfriend.co.za. My name is Big Daddy Liberty. I'm not alone in the studio. I'm joined by my colleagues from the Institute of Race Relations. These are very able minds, able voices, who I think you guys are very used to now, who provide some analysis in today's episode. The Monday edition of the show, of course, is just one which looks ahead into the week. What are the news items that you should be paying attention to? What are the big ticket items that we think you should be keeping your eye on? As I said, I'm not alone in studio. I'm joined by, let me start from my far end, Mr. Gabriel Crosser, a voice we haven't heard in a while. Gabriel, welcome back. How are you doing?
Thank you, Sidler. Very good to be back.
And of course, we have in studio a guy who I think you guys are very sort of fond of. He's also one half of the Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree duo. Nicholas Lorimer, how are you doing, Nick?
I'm very well, thanks.
Awesome, Chinese. As we look at the week ahead, guys, what are some of the topical issues that we think the viewers should be paying attention to? The one place I'll begin on, because we have a campaign on this that's launching this week, is the threat of prescribed assets. Politicians who are looking to dig into your pension in order to fund things like Eskom and NHI or whatever else really they want to fund. Guys, why is this a big problem and why should be people watching the news cycle for this?
Oh man, well, partly you need to watch out for pieces such as this Clive Eggers, who's the head of GTC. It's some investment branch. He's got a piece in the investment section of the independent media called Prescribed Assets, Too Soon to Panic. And I think you should expect more and more of this sort of people running interference, trying to tell you that because it's not already a law, you don't need to worry about it. And also, by the way, there are examples of other countries that have, how does he put it? As other countries that dictate what investors should do, but in a sort of healthy way. I'm not quoting directly, but that's one of the two arguments that are going to make. The first is don't worry about it; it's not a law yet. And the second is, well, other governments might be able to do it better. I think that listeners should be aware that when it comes to other governments being able to do anything, you know, you've always got to check what are these governments. I keep going back to Francis Fukuyama. There's the guy who said history's all over in the 1990s. Since then, he changed his mind. He came to Wits as one of the world's most famous economists earlier this year to sort of hammer away at one point. Throughout the 20th century, since World War II, the common sort of boring reduction of politics is, should the government be bigger or should it be smaller? That is an important question, but there's a whole other question, which is, should the government be more competent? And is the government already competent enough to do the things that it wants to do? If your government isn't competent enough to be able to turn the lights on, then it's definitely not competent enough to tell pensioners where to keep their money. So that's one thing. In terms of the other thing, this is not yet a law, so don't worry about it. Let's just remember that only last week it sort of came to light that the parliament, just before it dissolved, the last parliament dissolved just before the elections, rushed through a law that basically wipes out outstanding debt for a lot of poor South Africans that aren't able to repay their debts as they stand now. Now, that sounds like a good law. That sounds particularly like a good law for poor people, excepting that's the very short-run view. The Department of Trade and Industry commissioned a socioeconomic impact study into this, which found that in the mid-run, exactly what's going to happen is that things are going to be worse off for the poor because big banks that have real books that they can use to grant very cheap loans are going to totally pull out of the market. It's going to become dominated by loan sharks. And they said, don't do this if you want to be pro-poor. Guess what? Too late. The parliament already passed the bill. Ramaphosa already signed it into law. Why? Because these, you know, no one made a big song and dance about it. Unfortunately, it sailed under the radar, and so there was no pressure pushing back on the government, and so they didn't wait even for their own impact assessment to come through. So if you think this government is sort of going to wait for the socioeconomic impact assessment to come through on prescribed assets and then do whatever it says and you don't need to worry about it, then I think, you know, wake up.
Nick, a lot of good points are being raised here. And a lot of good points are being raised here, and it's really a culmination now, I think, of two things that Gabriel's maybe brought up here. One, the idea that predatory policies are on the way, and there is a zealous determination, if you will, by politicians to push them through. And then, of course, the second element is the idea that there should be a growing voice of people who are pushing back against these bad ideas. I think the IRR is in a very nice position in that regard in terms of what we're looking to launch this week, which is our campaign pushing back against prescribed assets. Why is it important to have voices like ours rallying South Africans, rallying the various sectors to actually push back against these bad ideas?
Well, you need to change the political calculus. So right now, the government is faced with some very difficult decisions in order to fix the holes in the fiscus. So we're spending a lot of money on the public sector wage bill. We're also spending a lot of money on things like Eskom and other state-owned enterprises that are going under. And right now, the easiest decision for the government is to look to get money from the pension funds, because otherwise they would have to either reduce the patronage networks or they'd have to take on the unions, which are two things they don't want to do. So if we as the populace, as the pension holders, raise the political cost of taking the pensions, then the calculus will change for the government and it might not look like such a bad thing to address some of the structural problems in the fiscus. Because if they think they can just get free money basically from the private sector or from individuals, then they're going to take that option because it's much easier for their political calculation.
Guys, I'm going to move on a little bit. Just a brief one, really, a bit of a funny one. The MEC of Education in this province, Panyaza Lesufi, tweets out over the weekend, basically taking pot shots at, I think it's Solidaritate, the union, who are, you know, they're doing a sod turning ceremony for what will be their new college. Let's call it a new college or TVET or university, whatever it actually may be. Now, this is a private organization which has rallied its members to chip in. It's probably gotten a bit of funding here and there, private funding to build something which they believe there's a demand for, which is Afrikaans medium institutions of learning. And here's Mr. Lesufi himself coming out and basically saying, let me just quickly go to his tweet, because it really was that asinine. So it's a picture of the actual sod, or a video, a little short video of the sod turning ceremony. And he then tweets over it, "I just hate racism when I see one, Sikh. A race-based institution in a non-racial society won't succeed. Please don't remind us about apartheid. Hashtag Afrikaans only." Now, bear in mind, nothing in the video suggests that this is a Afrikaans-only event, firstly, in terms of the sod-turning ceremony. And basically saying that your institution is Afrikaans medium is, you know, again, as I tweeted back, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. If a group of individuals in this country want to preserve their language, their culture in an academic institution, they're actually protected by the constitution for at doing this. However, Panyaza is doing something very nefarious, which is to suggest that a language in and of itself is racism. Gabriel?
Yeah, so just to say something particular about the Gauteng Education MEC, Mr. Lesufi, this is not the first time we've seen this from him this year. At the start of the academic year, Schweizer Reinecke, a small little school, large school, Schweizer Reinecke in the town of the same name in the Northwest Province, became headline news around the country. He was a big reason for that because he immediately chipped in with this line that that it's clearly a racist institution and that there are better things to do than get lost in race politics, and we've got to make our schools better. But sort of, you know, by standing on the faces of these teachers, who it turns out on thorough investigation by consulting, amongst other things, black parents, were totally not racists, right? So he kind of, he's clearly not into thinking too hard and reflecting too soberly on the question of race. If he sees something that seems to trigger him, then he pulls the trigger. In terms of the broader question, I think it is about Afrikaans. I think you hit the nail exactly on the head. One of the great travesties of the nationalist project of apartheid was to inculcate this idea that Afrikaans is a race. The history of Afrikaans really is a very multiracial history. If you look, you know, there are words like pisang, which come from the subcontinent. There's words, the double knee, which comes from France. A whole lot of it comes from Dutch. A whole lot of it comes from a real sort of soup, fruit salad of South African intermingling in the Cape and then across what we now call South Africa and beyond. And this wonderful sort of bouquet of originality is one of the youngest languages in the world. It's one of the most sort of user-friendly languages of the world as a result of sort of crossing so many divides and so many borders. And some of its great poets and music makers are certainly not white. All of this sort of became an embarrassment to the Afrikaner nationalist, Broederbond, hardcore racist grouping. And it's one of the perpetual problems in South Africa is that when a terrible racist idea becomes powerful, first it survives in the obvious way. You've got white Afrikaners who now insist that to be Afrikaans is to be white, and to be white is to be Afrikaans, and black Afrikaners and colored Afrikaners and the Afrikaners whose ancestors come from India, They're mere pretenders and they must go away. That idea starts out obvious and it starts out terrible and it starts out in a brutal way. But we managed to overcome this idea. Civil societies like the Institute of Race Relations, global pressure, domestic pressure from ordinary South Africans does a lot to change the political landscape. And one of the things that changes is that hardcore sort of coordination of violent force under the political umbrella gets removed and replaced. But the nut of the idea remains. And it remains in other people's heads. Lesufi doesn't identify himself as an Afrikaans person.
Yeah.
And he certainly doesn't identify himself as white, but he now does the work of identifying white and Afrikaner as one and the same thing, absolutely, perpetuating exactly the same old bad idea. And he's certainly far from alone in doing this.
And what I find funniest about this whole entire thing, and the army then of racial identitarian and race prostitutes, as I've been sort of calling them online as they come after me, is this weird idea that nothing that a group of private individuals can't do something for their own benefit unless some arbiter of race or some arbiter of what they think should be the standard born in this country has their say. In other words, unless Lesufi can stop this, unless he can, or if not stop it, unless he can slander it to a point where he paints it as being a bad thing, then we should only then accept these people and sort of deride them as being some sort of nutcase. And I found this really funny because one of the things I sort of tweeted, and I'm going to come to you, Nick, very briefly on this, is I have a problem with people who are so desperate to fit in that they then see their insecurities, or they project their insecurities out on a group of people who are choosing to do something for themselves. That is, here are a group of individuals, solidarity, whoever really. And I wouldn't have had an issue if this was like a Zulu lobby group that built a Zulu medium institution.
Yes, like that'd be great.
I'd have had no a problem with this because you do want a culture where people are actually developing South African languages to an academic level. We've never really had that before because of, ironically, the preference of one language over the other or two languages over the other. Anyway, Nick, the point I made online is if an Afrikaans medium institution is not your cup of tea, then find or build one that is. Thoughts?
So I think one of the things going on here is that there's this extreme amount of paranoia in race nationalism. You see this all the time. The assumption is if it's a Afrikaans medium university, this is all a smokescreen for the real agenda, which is to keep out black people. And this is a recurring theme in race nationalist ideology. Is you can see it in like the theories around white monopoly capital, is that, oh, there's this cabal of you know, sort of white overlords who are pulling the strings of everyone. And it's necessary for the whole thing to work. It's very similar, actually. And I know it's not a great idea always to go with Nazi analogies, but the Nazis kind of saw the same thing, right? It's like there's this empowered little minority, and likewise they were also race nationalists, and they believed that this was pulling the strings of German society and undermining the folk, the people, or except in this case, rather than the Aryan folk, it's the black nation. So I think
there is a kind of deep reason for that. It's slightly abstract, but just to give it a quick go, when you're super preoccupied, there's some things in life really are like this. If I have it, then that means you don't have it. And one of the things that's like that is a certain kind of social status. To be the best, there's only one person who's the fastest runner in the race, right? If he's won that race, that means the next person is second, the next person is third. Academics call this ordinal or positional qualities, positional properties. Then there are other things where, like, I can have more and you can have more. We do a bit of business. You know, I make more shoes, you make more chickens. We do a trade. We all come out better because we specialized. I think one of the great problems with race nationalists is that they tend to start out in a fixation on the positional properties.
The fixed pie.
Of, yes, we need to be the best. We need to get the most attention. We need to get the most respect for being whatever the group is that we are. And then when they look at the property market, when they look at economics, they don't see that you can have win-win, which is in fact the only thing that you really do get when you have a properly organized free market is win-win voluntary associations. And they don't see that with education, you know, it's like, it's another win-win. You're spreading good ideas. It's good for the environment, the social environment.
Guys, as we head to our last two issues, something I think people should be watching out for this week. Talk to me about Saudi Arabia, guys. What's going on there?
All right. So what happened last week was one of the major oil producing facilities in Saudi Arabia was hit by what was originally claimed by the Houthis, who are a group in Yemen who are closely allied to the Iranian regime, claimed that they had attacked this facility because they have a war with, they are at war with Saudi Arabia currently. And they claimed that they were attacking it as a response for this, and they used drones. Now, it later came out, there was some skepticism thrown on this by the Americans, by the Saudis, by the West in general, because firstly, 1,600 kilometers is how far away this area was from Houthi territory.
The area that was bombed, in other words, is super far away from...
Also, there were 19 targets hit by 10 drones, and they were all hit in the direction of the facility that faces towards Iran and Iraq. There was also some claims that they had found that the Saudis had then found the remnants of a cruise missile of Iranian manufacture at the site. I saw a photo of that online. I don't know whether it was actually true. So the accusation has now been made by the United States and the Saudis that this wasn't a drone strike by the Houthis. This was an attack with a cruise missile directly on Saudi oil-producing facilities, which appears to have affected about 5% of the world's oil supply, by the way. So it's quite a big deal. That was launched either by a Iranian-backed Shiite militia in Iraq or by the Iranian government itself from Iran. So this has raised tensions quite high in the Middle East, as you can imagine. There have been several incidents like this. There was the American drone that was shot down by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. There were the
sort of tit for tat hijackings of
tankers going on, oil tankers in the region. So it looks like things are set to escalate further. The Trump administration seemed to be making some suggestion that it was willing to talk to the Iranians, but then Donald Trump has come out and undermined his own press secretary when he said it's fake news.
Yeah, his press secretary says we're going to go have a chat without conditions with the Iranians. Then the story gets picked up on. Then Trump finds out that it's like doesn't really suit him anymore. So he says it's fake news. Unfortunately, coming from his own press secretary.
So the latest is that Trump has tweeted that America is locked and loaded. now he said stuff like this before.
Yeah,
fire and fury.
But yeah. Clearly, things are not going so well in the Middle East at the moment.
Guys, I want to come back to this issue because it's actually quite a big one insofar as the oil supply, the oil price, it will affect us eventually. And we'll probably have Ian Cruickshanks on the show on Wednesday. He'll talk us through the economic impacts of this. But guys, there has been tension in this part of the world ratcheting up quite significantly, with Iran being seen as the pariah state ever increasingly, even by the Arab League nations, by the way, who are ever increasingly taking exception to the Iranians. I mean, once you have a situation where the Israelis are being backed by Arab nations to essentially not openly attack per se Iran, but go after the Iranians, including their proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas, and et al. It kind of tells you that something big's happening in that part of the world, and we should be watching this in the news cycle, shouldn't we?
Yeah, I think it's one of the positives to come out of this are sort of Islamic people and Jewish people holding hands to go after common enemies. Breaking down, I think, one of the formerly intractable social identity cleavages in the region. I think one thing to notice about Iran is this one of the ways that it perpetuates trouble without sort of getting into as much trouble as it otherwise would is by having agents that act at arm's length. So there is the Iranian Revolutionary People's Guard.
Although that's part of the Iranian government, but also not fully under its own control.
Right. So when things go wrong or when if the stakes get high enough, it's got room to say, look, don't blame us. That was them. And this is something that generally happens, the sort of the more fragmented a society becomes, in particular, I mean fragmented in terms of the coordination of violence, the state's monopoly on legitimate force. The more you have sort of a military wing here, a military wing there, a police force doing that, an army doing that, and this is something that we've seen in other parts of the Middle East as well, you get a situation where you can't hold anyone responsible. And so it kind of gives license to all of the players involved to take the biggest chances that they can. It's sometimes worshipped by kind of quite naive university students. I was one myself, under the sort of auspices of the horizontal power structure, which is the kind of thing you see in the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street movement, is the kind of thing that you saw in Rhodes Must Fall, where there's no leader, there's no, you can hold us responsible if you do this. If one faction, if one fragment goes too far, then everyone else can sort of say, no, that wasn't really us. So you can't hold us responsible for what those people have been doing. So I wouldn't be surprised if the missile has been launched from Iran into Saudi Arabia and hard evidence is uncovered to back that up, that you'll find factions within the Iranian government saying, look, maybe that wasn't a great thing to do, but it wasn't us. It was these other guys. And, so don't come jumping down our back. And by the way, we're still working on our nuclear program.
Guys, in 30 seconds, just from each of you, top news items that you'll be watching in the week, just 30 seconds.
I'm going to be looking at the Mugabe's ongoing sort of funeral procession. I saw yesterday something about Thabo Mbeki returning to KZN for the first time since 2006, when he was booed out of KwaZulu-Natal, booed out of the Moses Madiba Stadium, basically, and booed out of politics. Seems like he might want to go back to have a memorial service for him there and reintroduce himself after such a long period of quiet diplomacy. One wonders what he might have to say.
Nick?
Yeah, I'm going to be looking at the debates on property rights going forward. Obviously, we've been talking a lot about this stuff, but I think there might be some interesting developments this week to do with EWC. And then also, we're going to continue looking at the stuff on prescribed assets and the debates around NHI.
Absolutely. Guys, from my side, look out for the Big Liberty Show. We're talking prescribed assets this week. I'll be hitting the streets of Johannesburg talking to you, asking you the question, are you willing to give up your private funds in order to prop up a company like Eskom, a state-owned company like Eskom, Transnet, et cetera, which are broke? And if you're not, are you willing to have a politician dig into your pocket in order to fund that? So we'll put that question to you this week. Guys, thank you so much for listening to The Daily Friend. Remember, you can find us online at dailyfriend.co.za. And hey, why don't you consider supporting the work that we do here by becoming a friend of the IRR. That is our crowdfunding campaign, which you can be a part of by SMSing your name to 32823. An SMS will cost you R1. Terms and conditions do apply, or alternatively, find us online at irr.org.za/join, and you can sign up a monthly debit order of R90 there. Guys, thank you so much. We'll see you on Wednesday on The Daily Friend.